a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, what role do teachers' unions actually play in whether or not there's a good education being produced for the kids? According to the Harvard Educational Review, there's a strong positive link between teachers' union and higher academic achievements among students. Researchers at the Indiana University in Bloomington and the University of South Carolina in Columbia examined rates of teacher unionization in all 50 states and compared them with interstate variation on SAT and ACT scores. The researchers, led by sociologist Brian Powell of Indiana University, found that the presence of teachers' unions appears to be linked to stronger state performance on these two standardized tests. On average, a state in which all teachers are covered by collective bargaining has an average SAT score that's 51.6 points higher than its unorganized counterpart. States with higher rates of unionization also appear to have higher ACT scores. Now comes the Cato Institution, Cato.org, Marie Griffin with us, suggesting no, not necessarily. Marie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm fine, and I hope you are well.
I am fantastic. Thank you.
Tell us, the press release you sent us said school choice can help improve the quality of the teacher labor force, thereby boosting school achievement and restoring meritocracy to the education system. Are you going after the teachers' unions?
No. Actually, I didn't review the relationship, if any, between union membership and teacher effectiveness. What I looked at was how the current education labor market is experiencing a really negative kind of attrition over time as the top teachers leave and the least teachers stay on. I don't find that that's a function of union membership per se, but rather a function of the compensation policies that public school districts have maintained.
In other words, we're not paying our teachers well, and so good teachers aren't sticking around?
Well, we're not paying good teachers well. Unfortunately, we're paying poor teachers rather too much, so they stick around longer than they should. That is, the best teachers are leaving, the poor teachers are staying on for a very long time.
And so your suggestion to solve this problem?
Well, frankly, if we could get rid of the worst teachers 2 years sooner, while keeping the best teachers 2 years longer, we could significantly improve the quality of the teaching force. To do that, we need to have the ability to dismiss poor teachers more easily than we currently do, and also to reward the excellent teachers for their merit. We can't do either under the current pay system.
You know, usually when I hear that kind of rhetoric, Marie Griffin, it's code for we need to break the bust up the teachers' unions.
Yeah,
they're the impediment to this kind of.
Honestly, I am. I looked at this from the perspective of the economics of the teacher labor market rather than the politics of how these pay scales get set. I can definitely see someone making the argument that we need to, you know, break up the unions because the unions are putting pressure on state lawmakers to institute these pay scales, and these pay scales are unhelpful to teacher quality. I can see one making that argument. I didn't research that issue, which is really a political science issue. The issue that I looked at was just the economics of the teacher labor market and how that's impacted by these pay policies, no matter who's in charge of putting them in place.
But the Cato Institute, being a libertarian think tank, is fundamentally opposed to the existence of unions from the get-go.
Yeah, it's not true at all. I believe there's a right to unionize. Now, I don't think that the National Labor Relations Act is necessarily the right legal framework.
You think that there's
a
right
to unionize? Probably inappropriately privileges unions over other types of organizations. But frankly, I'm not a labor expert. I'm an education expert. And what I've looked at in this paper is the labor market for teachers.
So you think that there should be a right to unionize, but you don't think that unionized people should have the right to strike?
I'm not prepared to talk about a subject that I haven't addressed in any of my professional research.
I see. Okay. So, and yet it seems that what you're doing is you're setting up the argument for taking on the teachers union. That I'm frankly a little baffled. It's like,
What I'm doing is orthogonal. I mean, the fact, I mean, basically what you're saying is that a person needs to have a sort of roll up the sleazy political agenda in order to conduct an economic analysis. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. Yes, it's a call for change, but the change that it's a call for is a change in how we manage schools and how teachers are evaluated. And it makes a pitch that if we have school choice, then principals will have both the incentive to hire top teachers and the freedom to hire top teachers. And those things are not true under the current political system.
But the Cato Institute
is a very collateral issue, and not one that I research.
Then by school choice, what do you mean?
School choice basically means any one of a wide variety of arrangements where a child's parents can take the entire amount of money that is spent on that child's education to the school that they have decided will be the best interest of that child.
In other words, vouchers for private schools?
Could be vouchers, could be tax credits that are refundable for low-income people. You know, there are sort of a variety of ways you could do this.
So we're talking about doing away with public education.
Well, I don't mind if every single public school that's currently doing business remains in business, as long as every child and every child's money is there because the parents decide it was best. So school out of business. What I'm talking about is forcing them to earn their customers' support.
Well, point in case, I have three children. Our first went through public schools all the way through. Our second went to a private school for a couple of years, and our third was homeschooled.
Mm-hmm.
I had the income that allowed me to have that luxury.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a scenario where a working family of two who are together earning $25,000 or $30,000 a year can do what Louise and I were able to do.
Income redistribution.
So-called school choice.
I mean, you need a big voucher or a large refundable tax credit so that working class people have the same opportunities that your kids did.
So you're suggesting that working class people should be able to get a $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 a year voucher?
I would actually be happy to make that deal with folks that are boosters of public education. I think that school choice for parents is so important to raising the quality of teaching that if folks who are defending the current system will allow parents to take that money anywhere they want, I will allow them to determine the size of the voucher that's appropriate.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that they're not going to determine it. It's going to be determined through a political process, and a large part of that political agenda is busting up public education and privatizing. I mean, ultimately, again, given the libertarian leanings of the Cato Institute, I would assume that you're suggesting that corporations, for example, for-profit corporations, could do a better job of running schools than the state.
I think, frankly, the public-private distinction is going to wind up being ephemeral if you have entirely competitive schools. So as long as schools get only the money that parents voluntarily bring into the door, whether they're called public or called private, they have the exact same incentives and will respond in the exact same way. Now, the only reason this might not be the case is if they were subject to different regulatory environments. That is, if, say, schools that were called public had to follow a lot of, you know, rules and regulations, schools that were called private didn't, but the result there is you just need deregulation so that you can allow folks to respond to parent demands.
So, I mean, if we look at the history of deregulation, if we look at the history of the privatization of a variety of things, power, for example, in the United States is a good example. It sounds very high at first. Oh, this is marvelous. You know, we're going to deregulate this. We're going to let the free market take its course. Things are going to be just fine. And then you end up with, you know, Enron shutting down California, flipping elections, bribing people, paying people off. You get
actually a terrible example because they did such a lousy job of it in the California legislation. A good example that I would point you to is the airline industry. We had an incredibly cartelized, priced, fixed, heavily regulated market in the airline industry. Jimmy Carter deregulated that, and today we have a wide variety of airlines who are all flying at below cost. They can barely cover their overhead because the industry is now so competitive, and that means that ordinary people can fly home at Thanksgiving to see their families,
I am guessing, Marie Griffin, that you're not old enough to remember or to have bought airplane tickets before 1982. I was in the business in the 1980s and in the airline in that industry and a consultant to that industry. And I can tell you, that small towns, because of regulation of the airline industry, you could fly in and out of small towns at a reasonable price. If I want to fly into or out of a small town right now, I mean, I can fly to New York City for less than I can fly to Lansing, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
That does not make sense.
Well, in a way, it does. For one thing, why should folks who happen to be living in inner cities, for example, subsidize, large farming, gentlemen farmers who are out there?
No, we're talking about the airlines. Prior to deregulation, we had healthy airlines. We had healthy employees. We had, the employees of the airlines were doing well. The airlines were doing well. They were guaranteed a certain profit. I mean, it wasn't wildly profitable, but they were doing well. After deregulation, we had a bunch of airlines go bankrupt. We have airlines in bankruptcy right now. We've got unions being wiped out. We've got employees who are getting screwed. And you think that that's a good model for education?
I think that right now people can afford to fly across the country at a very reasonable price, and this was not true 20 years ago. And I think that that's an improvement in quality of life. I really do. Now, that said, I should really stick with my area of professional expertise, which is the education market. If you want to talk more about that, that would be great.
Okay, and people, we have to wrap this up, but people can read about it over at cato.org. Marie Griffin, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kids to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter will be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting. Talk it over. Speak your mind. Decide to do something about it.
There you go. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Yesterday, millions of American workers lost their fundamental right to organize. As David Goldstein does a great blog over at the Huffington Post talking about it. And the point that he makes, unfortunately, in the last paragraph of his piece, I would put it right at the front. I would make it the first sentence. What this is all about is the fruition. The National Labor Relations Board, in the so-called Kentucky River decision, it's actually three different cases. In this decision that the NLRB did yesterday, National Labor Relations Board, stacked with Republicans, by the way, by George W. Bush, speaking, bringing this back to the context of should industries be regulated or not, and should the education industry be unionized or not. Should teachers be allowed to be organized and that sort of thing? Defunding the Democratic Party. That's really what this is all about. I'm telling you, this is about defunding the Democratic Party. And this was a plan that was put into place. They were talking about this out loud. Republicans were talking about this. Gingrich and these guys, they were writing strategy papers on it. They were published in the public media back in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan came into power. How do the Republicans, were asking out loud the question, how do we create a generation of single-party rule the way that Franklin Roosevelt did in 1932? Roosevelt had, basically 20 years where he was the only, where the Democrats ran everything. And it produced the American middle class of the 60s, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now, the Republicans want to take us back to the golden age in their mind of the robber barons, when 90% of Americans lived, literally 90% of Americans lived in poverty. But the robber barons did very well, thank you very much. And the Republican Party has, not always, it was originally founded as a progressive party, but by the 1870s they had become the party of the railroad tycoons and the robber barons, and they have been ever since. So how do we take the Republican Party and create single-party rule for a generation? And one of the major proposals that was put forward is defund the Democratic Party. Cut out from underneath the Democratic Party its money. Strangle it. Cut off its oxygen. This is one of the things, by the way, that led Bill Clinton and others to create the Democratic Leadership Council, where they said, okay, these guys, the Republicans, are having success. I mean, Reagan's, this all started in the Reagan administration, and they had considerable success in destroying unions and busting up unions because unions were supporting Democrats, and in stopping the flow of money to trial lawyers, defendants' lawyers, who were engaged in litigation against, like, the big tobacco companies or medical malpractice lawyers, and these lawyers were making enough money that they could be significant contributors to the Democratic Party. And so tort reform and union busting went right to the top of the agenda for the Republican Party, because they saw this, not because they thought that these were issues of great importance. I mean, down the road, they would like these things to happen. But, you know, they had their specific agenda really was the tax cuts that Bush has pushed through. I mean, this is privatizing Social Security and bankrupting Medicare and doing away with all of the so-called socialist programs. I mean, they want nothing less than, and they're quite specific about it, they're quite explicit about it, nothing less than to roll back the New Deal. Everything that Franklin Roosevelt did, they want to destroy. Unemployment insurance, the minimum wage, Social Security, workplace protections, the 40-hour work week, the ability to unionize. They want to destroy all of these things. As Limbaugh said,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And yesterday, the NLRB rolled back protections for basically 8 million American workers just lost the right to be in a union, because if you have any role in determining what hours somebody else may work, which in a lot of kind of jobs, like nursing, for example, a lot of nurses end up involved in decisions about who works when. They're not supervisors, but they're involved in that decision-making process. So they are now classified as supervisors, which means they're really not management. They don't own the company. They're not the opponents of labor. And they're not now legally allowed to be in the union any longer. 8 million people yesterday thrown out of unions. The union movement got that much smaller. When Reagan came into office, 25% of the American workforce was unionized. Day before yesterday, it was 7% of the private workforce in the United States. And minus 8 million workers, I frankly don't know what the percentage is now, but it's taken a huge hit. And is that going to help America? No, I don't. Absolutely not. And how should our education system be structured? Not just with regard to unions, but with regard to the whole issue of, should we privatize education the way that we privatize the airlines, the way that we privatize power? Well, the consequences, I think, were pretty grim in both cases. Do we want to do the same thing to education? The Republicans certainly do. We'll take your calls after this break. 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with them all. With a head of the shout, it's out from the town, and the rise of the factories fall.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars with Uncommon Sense and the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, announcing the October surprise contest in the Tom Hartman program message blogs. The first person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise, and of course we don't know yet, but anyhow, the first person to post the correct answer or the correct guess in advance gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner and four runners-up. Each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed. The winner will be announced on November 13th. 1-866-440-8466. The point we're talking about, really two issues. Unionization, broadly. I mean, this is the NLRB decision yesterday, Kentucky River case, stripped the right to unionize, to be a member of a union, from 8 million American workers. An attempt to defund the Democratic Party, to redistribute power to employers and away from employees, and to strip democracy out of the workplace. I mean, that's fundamentally what it's all about. And this is a war against working people that's been going on since 1981, when Ronald Reagan first declared it, when he busted PATCO. This has been going on for a long time. And should, in that context, education, as they bust up the teachers union, which is now the one of the larger unions that has survived 26 years of unremitting assault by conservatives, as they try to bust up the teachers union by privatizing education, should we privatize education the way we privatize trucking, the way we privatize the airline industry, the way that we privatized power in the United States, to the extent that it was done? It's just, this is nuts. Absolutely nuts. Your phone calls, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dixie in Seattle. Hey, Dixie.
Yeah, I'm worried about the fact that with privatizing schools, you have such complete control over your kids. They can take science out of the curriculum. They can introduce creationism. They can basically turn it into a theocracy, you know, like American...
Well, there are a lot of private schools
like
that.
Madrasa type things,
like,
huh?
Yeah, and there are a lot of private schools that are like that right now in the United States. The question is, should our tax dollars support them? And the Cato Institute would say, yeah, that's fine. Our tax dollars should support any. Well, I can't speak for them, but the logic of what was just argued was that, yes, we should be able to give vouchers to people who will take, who will send their kids to Christian or Muslim madrasas or whatever. And right now, if you want to send your kid to a private school, you have to pay for it. And I think that, you know, if we have a good, strong public education system, that's a good thing. That's a desirable thing. Thank you. A good point that you made, and much appreciated. Mike in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Yeah, well, Tom, I'd like to preface my comments by saying that I heard you on Bernie Ward's show on KGO, and right then I went out and I bought your book, and I like it.
Oh, well, thank you. Isn't Bernie great?
Yeah. Bernie Ward and Ray Taliaferro and Carell, they're one of the most brilliant liberal talk show hosts I've ever come across.
Yeah. I was just hanging out with Bernie there for about an hour, and it was a great time. Anyhow, that's not what you called about. You called about the National Labor Relations Board.
Right. I just want to make a point. Not only do I agree with what you say, but there's another point I want to add. One of the favorite tactics of employers is called divide and conquer. If they can get a workplace where like one half the people are not union and the other half is, then if the workers go out on strike, you don't have an effective strike, as opposed to having all the workplace in the union, and then of course you've got negotiating, bargaining clout when you.
Oh, this is what Taft-Hartley did back in 1947. In 1935, the Wagner Act was passed, and it said, yes, you can have a union. Yes, there will be a National Labor Relations Board that will protect unions and protect the right to unionize. And yes, if 51% of the people in a workforce say that they want to have a union, then everybody has to join because everybody is benefiting from what the union is doing. And everybody, in a democracy, ideally you want everybody to participate. So Taft-Hartley said, well, individual states can opt out of that, and they can say you can choose to be in a union or not, even if it's a unionized workplace. And so we had these so-called right-to-work states, mostly the southern states who took it, and that was the beginning, the slow beginning of the decrease in unionization. In 1947, when Taft-Hartley was passed, 35% of the American workforce was unionized. By the time Reagan came into office, it was 25%, so it had declined by 10% in that intervening, from 47 to 80, whatever that would be, 33 years, something like that. So, yeah, absolutely. And it's an absolutely terrible thing. And, Mike, thanks for the call. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I wanted to talk about, what differentiates the United States from a third world country? Well, in regards to public education, it's because whether you're poor or you're middle class, you still have the ability to educate yourself. And people in this country have to understand the importance of having that, because I think what your last guest was talking about is slowly, as they transfer money from public education into private, which they don't already need because people are paying $12,000-$15,000 a year to put their kids in those schools.
Yeah.
So they don't need the money. It's
minimum
education
for a decent school. Yeah.
But Tom, I have to tell you, I went to public school in Italy for almost 3 years. And this is public education, and they're not doing that well because they're competing against private. It's because the country puts money and despite all their corruption, but they do put a lot of effort into their education. I had to take geography. I had to know world history. I had to know Latin. I mean, I had to know ancient Greek. I mean, the philosophy. I had to know more information in public education in Italy than I had to learn here in college.
Right.
So, and I don't know if you've been to public education in Germany and so forth. You've
Yeah, three of our kids were in public schools in Germany for a year.
They're excellent.
They're brilliant. Yeah, they're very, very, very competent schools. And there is not a private bone in their bodies.
That's the point. That's
and they're entirely unionized.
Exactly, that you have to be private. I mean, we know once they private. Look at what happened to Social Security. Let's look, for example, Chile and England when they privatized their Social Security.
They went bankrupt.
Yeah, they went bankrupt. All these countries squandered the money away, and people were left with no pensions, no money.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway.
Good point. Good
Thanks
point.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Patricia. Well said. Mike in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I love your show. It's my number one show for getting true facts.
Well, thank you, sir.
I just want to point out that deregulation was done in the trucking industry, and what basically happened is instead of having, say, 200,000 independent truck drivers making a decent living, a good living, it took it out of their hands where there's only, the independent truck drivers, there's only a few left of them, and it's put the money into big business. And it's also a great political move because it's easier to get 10 big trucking companies to donate to your political party than it is to get 200,000 independent truck drivers to donate to your political party. Another point I want to make about the airline industry was, look what happened to the United Airlines employees that when they went to court, bankruptcy court, that the judge basically said, well, you lose your pensions.
Right.
And that went to the default government-funded program, which the taxpayers have to pay for, which is, I think it's $25 billion
yep.
in debt.
Yep, and it's not just United. I mean, Eastern went through this. Continental went through it. I believe American went through it. I'm not. I don't recall the details of whether American, whether American Airlines hit the pension, or not. But yeah, it's just disasters in the airline industry for the employees. And
yeah.
And in terms of the traveling public, yeah, from time to time, you can get a really good deal right now, particularly if you're flying from Los Angeles to New York. For people who live in the great big cities, because there's, lots of flights going back and forth, and so there's lots of competition, you can get a really good deal. But for people in the vast majority of America who want to travel to a medium or small-sized town, I mean, it just boggles my mind that here I live in Portland, Oregon. I can fly to New York City pretty much anytime I want, round trip for $200-$300. But if I want to go home to Lansing, Michigan, where I grew up, the cheapest tickets that I can typically find are around $700-$800. And that's halfway as far as New York City. But
yeah,
if I want to go to Chicago, where I've got to change planes to get to Lansing, I can do that, for $300. I mean, it makes sense in terms of, hey, this is how competition works in the marketplace. It makes no sense in terms of, is this good for America? And there are some things where you want the marketplace to win. I don't care what kind of shoes people make. I want the shoe market completely open to the free market. But things like a trucking, which has to do with critical infrastructure, the transportation industry, the railroad industry, the airline industry, frankly, the power industry, our telephone industry, and our education industry to the extent that it is, these, I believe, should have a healthy and strong amount of regulation so that the average person doesn't get screwed and so that workers can still be part of it. I just think that it's an absolutely critical thing.
Yeah, but
go ahead, Mike. Yep, we dropped Mike. Barb in Seattle. Hey, Barb.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
We just have a few seconds before we've got to take a break here.
Okay,
what's up?
Okay, your first caller just made me crazy. I do not understand people that have kids in private schools vote against the public school levies when we need an educated society. And to compare the airline industry to what we need to do with the school system is insane, because I would argue that the airlines are surviving on the backs of their employees.
Yes.
And ever since,
except for Southwest. Southwest is the most profitable airline right now, and it's the most highly and heavily unionized.
Yeah, and
go
the
figure.
Problem is that they go ahead and they make the other airlines compete with them since deregulation, and we don't charge what the ticket is worth. And so the way that they make up the difference is by getting cost cuts from all their employees. And by the way, American is the only major carrier that has not been in bankruptcy.
Oh, okay. Thanks for correcting me on that, Barb. I appreciate it. And thanks for the call. Hey, right now it's time for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day, the NLRB stripped 8 million Americans of the right of to do what? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed. Answer coming up after the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to The Pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman program. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. The question once again was, the National Labor Relations Board yesterday stripped 8 million Americans from the right to do what? And congratulations to Randy Hughes of Coloma, Michigan. And Randy, there you go. Randy knew that the correct answer is the right to unionize, the right to be members of a union, the right to collectively bargain, or any variation thereof. And good on you, Randy. Thank you for being the sixth caller knowing that. Just a heads up to our listeners in Portland in the Pacific Northwest. On October 5th, Thursday, tomorrow, I'll be at Annie Bloom's Books in Portland in Multnomah Village at 7:30 signing Screwed. And on the 6th, I'll be in Seattle at Town Hall. The Elliott Bay Book Company is putting this thing on. It'll be at 7:30 at Town Hall. The tickets are $5, and they're available in advance at Elliott Bay. So track them down for all that kind of information. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Judy in Dana Point, California on the line. Hey, Judy.
Hi, Tom. I had a thought. If they're going to make these people into management, or declassify them to management, then why don't they go and demand management pay, perks, and everything else that goes with management?
Well, that's the weirdness of this. They're in this weird netherworld where they have no management power, and certainly not the management pay or perks, and no stake in ownership, and yet they are barred now by law from being part of labor.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
it's bizarre.
It is bizarre, and it's just like, well, it's typical. I mean, it's just everything that's been going on. I have another, this is not related to, but it was on this Foley thing. If he was blaming everything on alcoholism and he left the floor to vote, to talk to his little friend on the phone, does that mean he was drunk making that vote?
Should he be charged with drunk while voting?
Right.
I don't know, Judy. The whole thing has gotten weird beyond my comprehension. I just
well, it's just so bizarre. I mean, I'm just
What I think is really going to take down the Republicans is the cover up, not the crime. I mean, that's very much off in the case.
Oh,
Judy,
agree.
I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call, though. Great to hear from you, Keith in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Hey, Keith.
How you doing, sir? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, a couple of points. First of all, I've been both sides, owner and worker, union and non-union. But when you mentioned about...
So have I, by the way.
What's that, sir?
So have I, by the way.
Okay. When you mentioned about Ronald Reagan with PATCO, you're right. However, you didn't mention about Bill Clinton with WTO.
I agree with you. Bill Clinton betrayed America by pushing right through GATT and NAFTA. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, and the one thing that really gets me is about the teachers. I do a lot of work in schools. And I can tell you right now, the majority of the cars that they buy are non-union and or non-American. They should practice what they preach. If they believe in a closed market, which I happen to believe in, a closed market, they should be buying Ford, GM, and Chrysler, because they're the only ones, with the exception of when Toyota builds their cars at a joint venture with GM, that use unionized labor. You got to practice what you preach.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Keith. Good to hear from you. That opens a whole other debate that I will have to save for some other time. It's an interesting one, though. Adam in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Tom. I want your first guest that was on and talking about deregulating the airlines to feel a lot more comfortable flying now that my father is missing half of his paycheck than he originally had about, I'd say, 3 or 4 years ago. And he has no pension, and with that pension, he lost probably $1 million to $1.5 million.
Is your father a pilot?
Yes, he's a captain at United Airlines. So
yeah.
He lost a good.
He lost most of his retirement.
Yeah, he lost all of his retirement, and he lost all of his retirement. They offered in some kind of stock option deal in return.
Yep.
And
here's a savings account. Good luck, Charlie. Yeah. No, you're
exactly.
Adam, good point, and thank you for making it. Clark, driving in Texas. Hey, Clark.
Hey.
What's up?
I've got a couple of things. One quick point is I think the 12 Democrats who voted for the habeas corpus thing ought to be kicked out of the party.
Well, they've most of them are already members of the DLCs, which I don't think of as the Democratic Party to begin with, frankly.
Well, agreed. Okay, but more generally, I think the whole nation needs a debate on what exactly it means to be capitalist and to be a socialist. I think as long as we're going to devise our system around the market, where the market is more important than the people, then I don't see any hope for any improvement in the problems we're having.
Yeah, the problem is that socialism is the wrong word. Socialism is a word that has been so badly demonized in the United States. And you know, and I have some knowledge of this. My father was a Republican in part in reaction to my grandfather being a socialist. I think what we need to be talking about is democracy in the United States. Democracy is a form of governance. Capitalism is simply an economic system. And we need capitalism. If we're going to have capitalism as the economic system in the United States, and I don't think that that's going to go away any day soon, and frankly, I'm not sure it should, then we need to have capitalism that is regulated by the democratic process. So we're talking about regulated capitalism. And let's just set aside
all the regulations that came out of the Roosevelt era were a response to the problems created by unregulated, by the very basic concept of capitalism.
Right, of laissez-faire, unregulated capitalism. Right, a raw capitalism.
We would have needed those regulations in the public school system, a lot of the other things, if we hadn't had to fight the power mongers.
No, you're absolutely right, Clark. Well said. And a lot of people forget the history of Roosevelt and how he took on the power brokers in this country. Coming up after the news at the top of the hour, Jeffrey Feldman with FrameShopIsOpen.com. And you're not going to believe what happened to a guy who walked up to Dick Cheney and said, "Sir, I find your policies detestable," and then walked off. I'll tell you about that right after the break, too. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Drowning in denial! Is that what America is doing? Jeffrey Feldman over at FrameShopIsOpen.com believes so. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Jeffrey Feldman, one of the nation's leading experts on framing, is with us. His website, FrameShopIsOpen.com. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. Just great to have you with us. Your lead story over at FrameShopIsOpen.com, FrameShop, Drowning in Denial. You're talking, of course, about Bob Woodward's new book and some of the revelations therein.
Bob Woodward's new book, and really bigger than the book, was this brilliant launch that they put out, getting Woodward all over the major networks and talking and getting an article out. I think it was a Newsweek magazine, in which he's framing the Iraq war and really the culture of the White House using this incredibly powerful concept, this word denial, which was, people will remember, was the concept that they used during the Watergate investigation, this notion of trapping people in non-denial denials, the idea that you lay out a set of facts that essentially break open what's going on inside a particular system where decisions are being made, in this case, the decisions leading up to and involved in the Iraq war. And really what he's done is he's trapped the White House. They are thrashing about, really not knowing how to get out of this particular frame. It's quite startling. It's getting a little bit lost considering that there's something else going on in political debate right now. But it really is an incredibly important story, and they've sent the president out now, and he's ratcheted up the rhetoric. He is once again accusing the Democrats of being very, very soft on terror. Even on the floor of the House, you've got a desperate attempt here to switch the debate back to danger in the middle of the country, that if the Democrats come into power, there will be nuclear bombs that will go off and so forth. And all this is a product of this one-word denial.
Well, the nuclear bomb, in my mind, in Bob Woodward's book, is 710, And I think that, you know, we should be doing everything we can to make 7/10 as much of a mantra as 9/11 is, because 7/10, July 10th, 2001, was the date that Condi Rice was told, and apparently as well, John Ashcroft and Louis Free and others were told that on a scale of 1 to 10, this was a 10 in terms of a threat to the United States, that bin Laden was coming. And between 7/10 and 9/11, they did absolutely nothing. And if that meme got out to enough Americans, if enough Americans got it, that Bush allowed 9/11 to happen by refusing to, by not paying attention to the intelligence that was being not just handed to him, but jumped up and down and yelled at him, then he could never again use 9/11 as his monster in the closet.
It's a really good point, and one wonders exactly what's in the minds of the actors who were involved in this event, George Tenet in particular. It seems to me that in reading these accounts and in following the Woodward book, that there's a lot at stake for these people in clearing their names initially, that they possibly don't have regime change in mind so much as they have clearing their own names in the history books. But if they were to start doing interviews on TV, were to start pushing that idea, then I think that the American public would start listening.
Yeah. Now, in the meantime, also at frameshopisopen.com, we're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief over at frameshopisopen.com. This whole Foley thing, you have a series of frames around the Foley issue that you're suggesting we should be considering.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, one of the things that's happened in the past couple of days is that the Republican leadership is trying to change the place where this scandal is unfolding. And the reason that they're doing that is very, very specific. Every crisis, every scandal unfolds in a particular place, and as a result of that place, there's a chain of blame that happens. So if there is a scandal taking place in Congress, then the chain of blame is going to involve the people responsible for that particular place. What they're trying to do initially, relocate Foley, call him an alcoholic and put him inside a rehab clinic. That was the very first thing they did within 24 hours of this breaking, relocating the place. And then more recently...
That was kind of the Patrick Kennedy thing.
Exactly. And then into the church, this claim that Foley was molested by a priest as a young child will allow them, if it sets in the media, to lay the blame on the Catholic Church.
Well, I don't think that was a political move as much as it was a legal one. I think he was trying to set up his defense should any of these pages ever try to sue him. Or does anybody try to prosecute him?
Absolutely. I think in political terms and legal terms are getting a lot of overlay here. But what the Republicans are desperately trying to do is avoid having this particular scandal stay trapped inside the Congress, and in particular on the floor of the House. And what's reinforcing that, I think, are a lot of the videos that we're seeing, these incidents that are being drawn up, where we have Foley on the floor under the guidance of the House leadership, notification that he is a predator potentially, and nothing happening. All these incidents taking place within the Congress itself, and so it's really important for progressives to keep the focus on the Congress and let this play out, because this is really a scandal about the leadership in the Congress.
In other words, you're suggesting that the frame that we should be pushing is not about, you know, Foley and what he did so much. I mean, that obviously is out there, and the public has framed that, and that frame is not
going
to change. You know, the guy was bad and he was wrong. Yeah, but the issue of Denny Hastert, or actually, I would take it even beyond Hastert, and certainly try to get John Boehner into this as well. That the Republican leadership, the senior level of leadership of the Republican Party, perhaps even Bush and Cheney, as the ultimate leaders of the Republican Party, knew about this and covered it up, that they were protecting predators.
Protecting predators because this particular predator was an incredibly powerful man. We're talking about a congressman who represented the county of Palm Beach, one of the wealthiest Republican districts in the country, had his finger on the tap of incredible amounts of donations. There's literally visual records, photographs of him at fundraisers, littered all over the internet, pictures of him with the likes of George Allen, with Jeb Bush. They're just out there everywhere. So this is really about Republican leadership protecting a powerful congressman instead of protecting the high school kids that were sent to work there.
And Foley was from Florida. He was a congressman from Florida, and
exactly.
he had been in Congress for, what, 12 years, as I recall? Some substantial period of time.
Quite a while.
Either six terms or 6 years, one or the other. And I'm wondering to what extent Jeb Bush may have known about this.
I think they definitely knew. I mean, Foley seemed to have come to prominence during the recount scandal. The Hanging Chad scandal took place in Foley's district. Remarkable.
And oh, really?
He was...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was an outspoken person during that time. That's really where he came into his own. spent a lot of time on television talking about the importance of really following this through and giving the election to Bush. Beyond Catherine Harris, who has become kind of the makeup face of that particular scandal, it was Foley who was the voice of that particular moment in 2000, and then
right.
continuing to rise, raising a lot of money in Palm Beach. I think that the story that's going to come out is that Foley was really a go-to guy for money in a very, very important important county.
Right, and a very wealthy county.
Incredibly wealthy. And, you know, here we have a leadership desperately concerned. In fact, it seems to be the only thing they were concerned about in Congress was shoring up their own majority, willing to look the other way, let an email slip under another pile, say that they didn't remember in order to keep that particular doorway open.
I'm talking with Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief at FrameShopIsOpen.com, about framing in the political debate. The Republicans have been trying to reframe the Foley issue, or they tried for a couple of days. I don't know if they're going to continue today, but I'm guessing that they will try to ride it for all it's worth, trying to reframe it as a gays are bad, in quotes, frame. And I suspect for some of their base that's sticking, that this really has nothing to do with being gay or not gay. This has to do with pedophilia. This has to do with children. Democrats have just been, you know, avoiding that. And I think that's probably the appropriate, well, actually, give me your take on this.
Well, I heard Rick Santorum say that he accused the Democrats.
Rick Man on Dog Santorum,
exactly.
As Rachel Maddow calls him, yeah.
He accused the Democrats of not being supportive of gay people. This kind of a ridiculous statement that he made, that, you know, it's okay for Foley to be gay, which is his underhanded way of trying to frame this about homosexuality, when, of course, it's not. But look, the issue here is, you know, think of this in terms of your high school kids going off on a study program, and they show up, and the counselors in charge of them were using predatorial behavior. So this is not about whether or not a person is gay or straight. It's about predatorial behavior and the responsibility of the people in charge to do something about it and to
right.
step in between a danger and America's sons and daughters.
Although, you know, last night Pat Buchanan was on, I think Chris Matthews, going on and on about how this kind of thing happens more often in the gay community. My understanding was the stats were, maybe the Catholic Church scandals have skewed the numbers recently, but historically the stats have been that people who prey on children are more likely to be straight than gay.
Yeah, I mean, Buchanan has been particularly shameful on this, and no Democrat has yet to really respond to him forcefully. He's made the argument that that typically Democrats allow for this type of behavior because they have lower standards than Republicans. It's incredible how he said that.
Yeah, they're trying to flip the whole thing and you know, bringing out Jerry Studs and everything. It's just amazing. Jeffrey Feldman, FrameShopIsOpen.com, the website. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
As always, great talking with you. I always learn something. 16 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. For a change!
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Little village baby, you're large enough to be a town. From a little village baby, you're large enough to be a town. From the city, gonna bring it down.
And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Did you know that coffee originated in Ethiopia? That's in any case, there's a whole huge selection of coffees available over at Organic Ground at sacredgroundscoffee.com. They're all organic, they're all fair trade. And now, if you type fall, F-A-L-L, like the season that we're going into, if you type fall into the coupon field, when you check out, you'll get a 15% discount over at sacredgroundscoffee.com. one of our sponsors here on listener-supported radio, Tom Hartman Program, Small Dog Electronics, another. Get the latest iPods now at 1-800-511-MAX or smalldog.com. And Sacred Grounds Coffee's phone number, 800-425-2532. And also, please be sure to support your local sponsors. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Carlos in West Orange, New Jersey. Hey, Carlos, what's on your mind,
buddy? Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Sorry, my phone is ringing on you.
That's okay. You want me to put you on hold?
No. Okay. I wanted to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Who gets to make the decision about who gets to stay in the union and who's not? That's just one thing you can
say. The National Labor Relations Board.
Right.
That's what this was all about.
Right. What I'm saying is that in my job, right, we have like a head bartender, but he's not like, you know, a head bartender. I mean, he kind of, you know, give out supervisory job, but he's not a supervisor.
Right.
And I know the union would, my union in particular, would just say, look, if you're in the union, you've been in the union for 25 years like he has, now they're going to remove you from the union because you're the head bartender. Well, then you just don't give any directions or instructions. You let the management do that.
See, here's how they play the game, Carlos.
Huh?
Here's how the game gets played.
Okay.
The employer would say that, you know, the guy who's the head bartender is right. Now part of management. They would simply designate him that.
Oh, that's what I wanted to know.
Then the union would say, but wait a minute, he's not really management. Right. And then the employer goes to the NLRB and says, yes, he is management because he gets to set Carlos's hours. And the NLRB says, yep, he's part of management and under this new decision. And the union has no say in it. Once the employer designates him as management, if he has any kind of control over anybody's hours, then boom, he's out of the union.
Yeah, I just wanted to say one more thing. I'm sorry, you
sure.
know, to hold up all your time. But the thing about it is that the head bartender is like, if let's just say we work by rotation. Like we work, you know, one guy gets one job, one guy picks up the next. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that goes by seniority. So when that guy's not there, there's always somebody else there who has the most seniority. That you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if you go by that, they're gonna say, well, yesterday you did it, the day before. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know.
But still, the employer can say, it doesn't matter. This guy is making decisions.
Right.
You know, I mean, and if there's even a shred of truth to it, see, what you have to get is that the NLRB, which was created in 1936 to defend the rights of organized workers,
right.
is now stacked with Republicans and has been converted into a federal institution whose job is to destroy the rights of unionized workers.
Right. Yeah, I think I'm going to have to call my organizer and some people just got to change their classification right away, you know?
Well, the only way that this is going to be changed is if Democrats take back the White House in 2008, and because it's the president who appoints the members of the National Labor Relations Board, and right now I believe it's a five-person board, and there's two Democrats and three Republicans, and the president can flip that bias.
Right, but, so. Because you know why? I work in New York City in the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, it's kind of vague, you know, what I'm saying. Like, but in other hotels, they're different. They have the same job. Like, they have a captain, waiter, a head bartender. I mean, they're classified as that. Mm-hmm. We just kind of do it by seniority. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, I mean,
it doesn't matter. Somebody is determining what that seniority is, and that person is probably going to be designated as a manager.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I'm telling you, that's how weird it is. I got to move along, Carlos, but thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just got done watching Ben Bernanke's speech from the Fed.
Were you talking about how the baby boomers are going to strain the U.S. economy?
Well, here's the thing. I beg everybody to read the transcript of that speech, but keep this in mind. The real core thing at this is that what they're afraid of is the coming labor shortage, the brain drain as the boomers leave the corporations.
Well, it's not just the brain drain. It's that in the presence of a labor shortage, the price of labor goes up, which will cause the middle class to reemerge and will cause unions to come back in a strong way. And I predict that's absolutely going to happen unless they can bring in another 10 million immigrants from outside the United States to try and balance that out, which they're trying to do, by the way. They're trying to open up the visa program and everything else.
Yes, the immigrants is solved on the manual labor side,
yeah.
But they're afraid of the rainmakers leaving, the big, you know, the key employees, the people with the experience, and because corporations really haven't.
Actually, I would say Dave, that it's not that they're afraid of the rainmakers leaving. That's what they're saying. What they're afraid of leaving is the average working person who and the demand for that is going to drive up, as I said, the wages of the middle class. And that's what they don't want, because if the wages of the middle class go up, the wages of the CEOs go down. That's, you know, historically, that's always been the case.
Yes,
Dave,
sir.
We'll have to see how it shakes out. Dave, I got to run. Thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods, the Crips, and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate. And to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get outraged. Yeah, madness, but you demonstrate. And that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let the soul gravitate to the love, y'all.
We're all killing people, dying, children hurt, hanging and crying. And you practice what you preach, and that you send me for the key. Father, Father, Father.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. By the way, tomorrow night I'll be at 7:30. Thursday night I'll be doing a book signing at Annie Bloom's Books in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah Village. And Friday night, October 6th, I will be doing a book signing and a good rant. We're going to have a great time at Town Hall in Seattle. It's sponsored by the Elliott Bay Book Company. You can get tickets for $5, which basically pays for the rental of Town Hall, over at Elliott Bay. So give them a call or drop in or whatever. Elliott Bay, 624-6600 is their phone number if you want some more information on that. So this is a little bit of good news just got here. The Publishers Weekly. You know, I wrote this book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And you know, a couple of my books have been, you know, like We the People. People review them. I mean, kind of mainstream reviewers review them, and they go, oh, that's kind of a left-wing screed. But Screwed, we tried to put this thing together in a way that anybody in the political spectrum could read it and get a good take on it. And here, Publishers Weekly says, despite its sensationalist title, Hartman's latest book is an intelligent critique of the contemporary plight of the middle class. Isn't that great? So, thank you very kindly for that. And now, you're not going to believe this. Yes. Totally strange. A Denver area man filed a lawsuit yesterday against a member of the Secret Service for causing him to be arrested after he approached Vice President Dick Cheney in Beaver Creek this summer and criticized him for his policies concerning Iraq. Attorney David Lane said on June 16th, this is from, by the way, by Charlie Brennan in the Rocky Mountain News, on June 16th, Steve Howards was walking his 7-year-old son to a piano practice when he saw Cheney surrounded by a group of people in an outdoor mall area shaking hands and posing for pictures with several of the people. According to a lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court in Denver, Howards and his son walked to about 2 to 3 feet from where Cheney was standing, and he said to the vice president, quote, I think your policies in Iraq are reprehensible, end quote, or words to that effect, then walked on. 10 minutes later, according to Howard's lawsuit, he and his son were walking back through the same area when they were approached by Secret Service agent Virgil D. Gus Richel Jr., who asked Howards if he had assaulted the vice president. Howards denied doing so, but was nonetheless placed in handcuffs and taken to the Eagle County Jail. The lawsuit states that the Secret Service agent instructed that Howard should be issued a summons for harassment, but that on July 6th, the Eagle County District Attorney's Office dismissed all charges against Howards. The lawsuit filed today alleges that Howards was arrested in retaliation for having exercised his First Amendment of right of free speech and that his arrest violated his Fourth Amendment right of protection from unlawful seizure of his person. And I would, you know, I think you could probably argue the Fifth Amendment as well, but in any case, what's interesting is that this was all before last Friday when the laws changed. Now, if Howards walked up to Dick Cheney and said, I think your policies are reprehensible, Dick Cheney could simply call George Bush and say, this guy, Mr. Howards here, he's an enemy combatant. He's a hostile combatant. We have to declare him an enemy combatant. And George W. Bush could say, okay, this guy, Mr. Howards, is an enemy combatant. What's his, Steve Howards. He's an enemy combatant, and he could be disappeared. Just like in Chile under Pinochet. He could be disappeared. He could simply vanish from the face of the earth and never be seen again. Never charged with a crime. Never have the right to call a lawyer. Never have the right to call his family. Simply vanish. And we have no idea right now in America, since last week when the Senate passed this legislation, well, I don't think the president has signed it yet. But we have no idea how many people have been simply vanished, because this basically retroactively says what he did with Jose Padilla, which is what he did. Bush took a U.S. citizen and vanished him. And nobody knew about it for months until it leaked out. We have no idea how many people so far have been vanished in the United States. So it's amazing what's going on here. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Angela in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you wanted to make a plug for the World Can't Wait in the Grand Rapids area tomorrow?
Yes, we're getting together at the Calder Plaza downtown, and right at noon, like all the other protests around the country, and hoping a lot of people will show up so we can get on the news and show our support for, right, you know, a new fresh start for America here. This is getting ridiculous. So.
It is, and so I wish you well, and all the listeners of WTKG in Grand Rapids who are listening to our program live right now. Once again, where and when?
It's October 5th, Thursday at noon at the Calder Plaza downtown.
Angela, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Good talking with you. Bill in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bill.
Hey, what's up, Tom?
I'm here. What's on your mind?
Listen, I'm calling about our Cato Institute, from the Cato Institute.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to find, how do these people always know it's the best teachers that leave?
That's a good question.
Where do they get that information from?
That's a really good question. I wish I had thought to ask her that.
Yeah, I know. They all love to throw these little things around. Anyway, I'm the retired detective from Chicago that calls you periodically.
Yeah.
I also had a substitute teach for medical bill reasons in my youth.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I bummed around a lot of the worst schools in the system in Chicago, obviously, because, you know, that's where you go when you're a substitute.
Yeah.
And I, first of all, there's always a procedure to fire teachers.
Sure.
They always exist.
Yeah.
Now, the principal might have to jump through a few hoops to do it, but it was there if they wanted to do it.
Well, the fact of the matter is that it's not in the interest of the teachers' union to have bad teachers in schools either.
Right. And the other thing is, I don't know of any union contract that stops people from being paid more or being given bonuses.
You're right.
You know,
although
they want to reward the best teachers, you know. And the other thing was really
what she wanted to do was privatize education.
Right,
I mean, that's the bottom line, you know.
Obviously, this is the move. You know, when I first made detective in Chicago, we didn't have a contract, and what they used to do was come down periodically with the 10% dump list, where they wanted to get rid of the deadwood, you know, supposedly.
Right, right.
Well, let me tell you, in my year's experience, the deadwood was never gotten rid of. They called their political sponsors and ended up staying, and some poor guy who was out there doing his job who didn't have anybody to call was the guy who got dumped.
Right, and that's why you need a union, because then you've got somebody to call.
Right, and they have to justify why they're getting rid of you. Nobody's saying they have to keep bad people. It's just give some justification. You have to put it down on paper. Why has this guy got to go, you know?
Yeah, good
and
point, good point.
There was, you know, when Milwaukee went to the voucher system, there was a woman on television, I think it was on one of the PBS programs, and she was their main reporter for education up in whatever newspaper, the big newspaper in Milwaukee is. And she said a couple of years after they went to the voucher system, she went to these schools to try and get some facts and everything to see how they were doing.
Yeah.
And she was told that was private corporate information, and she wasn't allowed to see it.
It's proprietary.
Yeah, right.
And it truly is. It truly is. And everything just kind of vanishes into a black hole if it's a for-profit corporation.
Yeah, right. So are they willing to give up their lock on their
proprietary?
You know?
No, they're not. No, they're not. You know, I guarantee you that. Bill, thanks for the call. Good points. Good points, all, and much appreciated. Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Quick comment and then a question. Quick comment is, you know, this idea about, yeah, you can just take a voucher and send your kids to another school doesn't work in rural areas where there aren't any other schools to send them. And if these people could snap their fingers, create the world that they want, would the school be paid for only by the parents who are currently have kids in there with the vouchers?
Right, and then you end up in a situation where we are not, as a society, educating the next generation, and only the wealthy parents end up paying for it. You're absolutely right, Larry. Good point. Thank you very much. Chuck in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Chuck.
Hi, Tom. I want to repeat my compliment that I gave you via my winning a book once. You are the oxyacetylene torch in a sea of sputtering Bic lighters. In any case, it definitely is a compliment just from my analysis.
Well, I'm not disappeared yet, Chuck. I'm
okay, well, I'm worried about me. I want to say I was galvanized by your piece about, you know, how this thing is throwing rice off the front page. But she squirmed out of so many things, and I watched all the news. It's still on McNeil Air. It was on three of the other ones. It sells, it's sex. It's not selling on Fox because, you know, they, you know, for some reason this is one sex.
You're talking about how the Foley scandal is pushing the fact that Rice was told on 7/10 that 9/11 was coming, and from 7/10 till 9/11 did absolutely nothing, is pushing that off the headlines of the papers, which is what I've been complaining about for 3 days.
Well, what I'm saying is I had an about face because I think this reveals the contradiction, the basic contradiction in the Republican Party. They're the family values people, and then they're the unrestrained, nature red in tooth and claw capitalist people that will push pornography and take donations from these people.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is they're people, they're apologists having a hard time spinning it.
Absolutely, Chuck. And they're having a very difficult time spinning it. But on they will go with it, I guarantee you that. 45 minutes past, and thanks for the call, Chuck. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mama, it's hard to hide, because you know I'm 6'5". In a land where the people are short, I just slip on a burka, head on down to Lawyer Jurgen, poke around all day at the Sharia court. I should be in heaven behind 9/11. By now, at least that's what I thought. But to be a martyr, you gotta get slaughtered, and to do that, you need to get caught. Tired of waiting around for the bushes, I pass the time, I do what I can.
The lament of Osama bin Laden. Well, now, you know, Frist goes over to Afghanistan and says, well, let's bring the Taliban back. Yeah, let's put the women back in the burqas. Good plan, Bill. Yeah, real smart. Oh, my. In just a second, Alan Ratner is going to join us from the TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service. But first, Shelby in Pittsburgh wants to plug a World Can't Wait event in Pittsburgh. I want to get as many of these things on the air as possible. Hey, Shelby.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, too. Listen, I wanted to let all of your WPTT listeners know that we have put a lot of work into trying to organize a major event here in Pittsburgh. And we've passed out over 2,500 flyers to the University of Pittsburgh and another 2,000 to Carnegie Mellon University. And we're really trying as hard as we can to get as many people out as we can. And we're going to be meeting at Point State Park downtown at the fountain where the Three Rivers meet. And we're going to proceed with a march from there up through Boulevard of the Allies through the downtown business district.
Great.
And
So real quickly, where and when people should start out, Shelby?
Okay, we're asking everyone to meet at 11:30 a.m. sharp at Point State Park.
Great. Okay, 11:30 a.m. Point State Park to all our listeners on WPTT in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Shelby, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Great to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number. We'll get back to that in a few minutes. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
We are hearing that the Republicans are not now as anxious for Hastert to go away over this, although, again, I have heard that there certainly are other instances of some kind of harassment, adult-to-adult harassment, that have taken place by some Republicans that we're hearing about. So,
oh, my.
So,
in other words, some sex scandal spreading. I'm curious, the Fox TV yesterday was running Foley as a Democrat in their crawl across the bottom. D-Florida, it said after his name. And, in fact, there's a picture of it on Drudge, of all places. And I understand that they're still doing this today. Fox News has reinvented Foley as a Democrat. Is this...
I did not see that, and I'm going to have to look at Drudge. I'm shocked. I mean, honestly, I would be, as somebody who works for Fox News, I'm speechless, because that's generally not the kind of thing that I've ever seen them do.
And it was on O'Reilly's show last night, and it was, you know, apparently.
But they're running him as a Democrat.
Yeah, it says, as they're doing the story, the you know, underneath there's the slug, you know, the not
right.
The crawl, but above the crawl, the slug that says, or whatever they call it in TV, that says Mark Foley, D-FL, Democrat from Florida.
Oh, my gosh. Well.
That's the graphic.
I'm speechless.
Apparently 2 days in a row, Fox News. They've reinvented Mark Foley as a Democrat.
Speechless.
Yeah.
Speechless.
So.
Okay, what can I say? Let me go on and just say a couple other things. The president today is in Rick Renzi's district in Arizona, and I have to know a lot about that race because my friend Ellen Simon, who I've known since I've been 3 years old, is the Democratic candidate.
Oh,
and what's so interesting about it is she doesn't need much money to win against Renzi, but the Democrats are not supporting her.
Why not?
However, because they don't consider it as a competitive race, even though it's in one of the 50 competitive races.
Right.
They won't send anybody out to her fundraisers. But Bush thinks enough about this race that he's taken his time to go out there.
Do you know of a website for her that we can...
EllenSimonForCongress.com.
Is it FOR Congress?
FOR Congress, that's
Ellen,
right.
Ellen, S-I-M-O-N, like Paul Simon?
And,
Ellen,
you know, and her parents are Holocaust survivors. I mean, I've known Ellen since I've been 3 years old. They were my parents' best friends when they came over here for escaping from the Holocaust. The mother was one of 200 women that lasted on that long march of 5,000 people. I mean, she's got an incredible story. And the Democrats are not willing to support their own, and Bush is out there helping them.
Well, if anybody's wondering where to send, you know, if you've got $25, $50, $100, whatever you can afford, Ellen Simon for FORCongress.com, a great candidate here. I'll always take your endorsements, Ellen.
And trust me, she is a great candidate.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Democrats, there is so much that is possible right now among, you know, for this thing is just wide open. Ellen, is the 7-10. I we need to be pounding this thing. 7-10. 7-10, Condi was told 9/11 is coming. And between 7-10 and 9/11, the Bush administration did nothing.
Nothing.
If enough Americans got that, Bush would never again be able to talk about 9/11. Is that going to happen?
Well, I got to tell you that the problem is, of course, this Foley thing has taken people's attention away from what we are now hearing, both from the Woodward book and from everywhere else.
Yeah, yeah. So it's sucking all the air out of the room.
Is this another dirty trick? Even though I don't think it is, of Karl Rove.
Did the Republicans decide to crash Foley? Yeah, if Karl Rove didn't realize that there was a cover-up and that Hastert was involved and that this thing might creep beyond Foley, did they decide to give up one of their own to protect the president? It wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it's not inconsistent with the way that they've done things before. It just wouldn't surprise me at all. So, amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. And Ellen Simon for Congress.com. Ellen's friend is running for Congress in Arizona. Check it out. 56 minutes past the hour, telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, here's the hot news. In a stunning development that could radically alter the electoral landscape in the upcoming midterm elections, the singer Michael Jackson announced today that he will run for the seat vacated last Friday by former Representative Mark Foley, Republican from Florida. Mr. Jackson told reporters that he had never shown much interest in politics before, but added, quote, "When I started reading about Mark Foley, I realized that the House of Representatives was my kind of place," end quote. Platinum-selling recording artist drew big crowds on his first day of campaigning, delighting onlookers in Orlando by getting out of his limo and dancing on its roof. House Republicans expressed muted support for Mr. Jackson's election bid, with Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert saying that he knew of nothing in the singer's past that could prevent him from serving ably in the House. Michael Jackson, he said, has done a lot of positive things, especially in the field of mentoring. According to Buddy Schlantz, a veteran talent agent and observer of the entertainment scene, transforming himself from king of pop to congressman from Florida could prove to be a shrewd image makeover for the tabloid-ready Mr. Jackson. As Mr. Schlantz said, "In the outside world, Mr. Jackson, Michael Jackson, seems weird and maybe even a freak. But once he's in Congress, he'll seem perfectly normal." Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for that. It's the funny side of it, but there is a serious side to it, too. And there's a weird side to it. And for example, and as I said, they're showing this over at Fox News, over at the Drudge Report, and Mark Foley is being, on Fox News, is being called a Democrat. They refer to former Congressman Mark Foley, D-FL. They have reinvented him as a Democrat on Fox News. Now, why would they do this kind of thing? Why would Fox News intentionally mislead their viewers? Now, I'm not suggesting that this Mark Foley, D-FL, is entirely intentional, but there has to be more than one person in the loop who saw that graphic, who knows that the guy's a Republican. I mean, you got the producer, you've got whoever generated the graphic who should be fact-checking, you've got the on-air talent, there have to be dozens of people who should have immediately seen that and said, "Hey, wait a minute, that's wrong, fix that." And they didn't. And I think one of the things that gives us some fascinating insight into this, There's two stories I want to tell you about Fox News, and then we'll get to your phone calls, and we've got an Iraq alert and just a few other things here this hour. But Rebecca Dan, in the October 9th issue of the New York Observer, now that obviously it's not yet October 9th, it will shortly be out. Magazines, predate their editions a little bit. Rebecca Dan goes in and interviews Roger Ailes. The article, in fact, it's called The Fox in Winter. Roger Ailes, Fox News' Luciferian TV genius, happy at last, made Rupert Murdoch billions, whacked American politics. What would have happened if his dad had caught him? This is the subhead. Now, what does that mean? She starts out, "I'll hug you," said Roger Ailes. "I'll hug you even though you're a journalist." "A journalist," he repeated, mid-embrace, as if tasting bile. Later, he said, "I love the news business." Yeah. Although she points out, Rebecca Dana points out in this article in the New York Observer, that Roger Ailes is the president of Fox News. He's the guy who built the network. He used to be an operative for Ronald Reagan. He recently issued an edict, something he does from time to time, that any Fox employee who received a journalism award would be terminated on the spot, quote, "because that means you sold out," end quote. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. I'm quoting from Rebecca Dana's piece in the October 9th issue of the New York Observer. It's called The Fox in Winter, about Roger Ailes. And just listen really carefully to this. "How can one trust journalists
when nothing written is ever accurate. When Roger Ailes was very young, he was born in 1940 in Warren, Ohio, about 5 or 6 years old, the age his son is now. He was playing outside one afternoon, walking an imaginary tightrope on a tall brick wall behind his house. His father, an employee of the Packard Electric Plant, came outside and playfully urged his boy to jump. "Come on, I'll catch you," the elder Mr. Ailes said as his son remembered it and motioned with his hands. "Come on, jump!" The boy took a breath and leaped off the wall toward his father's waiting arms. Mr. Ailes withdrew, letting his son fall to the ground. "He picked me up," Mr. Ailes said. And he said, "Never assume and don't necessarily trust anybody." This is where it had a searing impact on me. End quote. Roger Ailes, 6 years old. His dad says, jump off the brick wall there and I'll catch you. He jumps and his dad steps back and lets him crash into the ground. What kind of weirdness has this created? I mean, for example, now this is not Fox News, this is Fox overall. We're back to Murdoch and company, I guess. Back in 1998, a couple of Fox, this is not, again, not Fox News, this is a Fox television station down in Florida. A couple of reporters, Jane Acree and Steve, what's her husband's name? Don't have it right in front of me. Anyhow, and her husband were working on a story about RGBH, recombinant bovine growth hormone, and its effects on humans. You know, is this stuff a carcinogen? Is this stuff dangerous? What can it do to people? Fox comes to them and says, and what they found was that, you know, hey, maybe we should have some concerns here. So Monsanto goes to Fox and says, you're not going to really run that, or words to that effect. Perhaps there's a legal threat. And so Fox goes to these two reporters, Jane and Steve, and says, you have to change the story. They changed the story a number of times, but finally reached the point where Fox was insisting that they lie in the story. And they said, no, we're not willing to. So in fact, you can find all this over at the foxbghsuit.com website. BGH as in bovine growth hormone, foxbghsuit.com. And here you will find the behind-the-scenes details of how a large share of America's milk supply has quietly become adulterated with the effects of a synthetic hormone, BGH, secretly injected into cows, and how pressure from the hormone maker Monsanto led Fox TV to fire two of its award-winning reporters and swept under the rug much of what they discovered but were never allowed to broadcast. After a 5-week trial and 6 hours of deliberation, now what the trial was about was they fired Jane and Steve because they were unwilling to lie on the air, on TV, and say, oh, everything's fine with BGH. And so Steve and Jane sued them for unlawful dismissal, saying they were fired, you know, they broke their contract with them as on-air talent and as reporters without cause. And a 6-person jury down in Florida, a jury of their peers, unanimously ruled that, well, here, after a 5-week trial and 6 hours of deliberation, which ended August 18, 2000, a Florida state court jury unanimously determined that Fox, quote, had acted intentionally and deliberately to falsify or distort the plaintiff's news reporting on BGH, end quote. In that decision, the jury also found that Jane's threat to blow the whistle on Fox's misconduct to the FCC was the sole reason for the termination, and the jury awarded $425,000 in damages and made her eligible to apply for reimbursement for all court costs, expenses, and legal fees. But the story didn't end there. 3 years later, February 14th, 2003, Fox appeals this. They go to a federal appeals court. A couple of Reagan appointees on the, a couple of Republican appointees on the court. And the judges in the appeals court reversed the ruling and said essentially, well, Fox has the right to lie. They have, you know, free speech. They have the right to lie. And Fox News came out and said that they had been vindicated. As, you know, I mean, just, yeah, we've been vindicated. Everything is well now. It's really quite mind-boggling when you consider it. I mean, I just don't know how to say it beyond that. It's just quite mind-boggling. And so Fox News, now that was a Fox television station, so Fox News reinventing Mark Foley as a Democrat, Roger Ailes apparently not trusting anybody on earth, and you just, at a certain point, you kind of put all this stuff together and you get it that there's a really weird worldview out there that is represented by many people on the right that essentially the ends justify the means, that the strong have to prevail over the weak because you can't trust anybody, that the essential nature of humans is evil. Don't you know about original sin? Yes, it's all Eve's fault. Therefore, women should be repressed. So Bill Frist goes over to Afghanistan, and yeah, let's just bring back the Taliban, and you know, all this kind of stuff. It's just out of control. Out of control. I don't have a therefore for you on this. I think it's just understanding this is half of defeating it. And most Americans, I think, don't have a clue. They don't understand the genesis of this tragic and twisted worldview that is called conservatism in America. 17 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I've got to hear. Oh, I feel nice.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. by the way, Link TV is going to run a four-hour special. Friday, October 6th, Wednesday, October 11th, and Saturday, October 28th. LinkTV.com if you're not a subscriber, if you don't get it through satellite or whatever. And it's called Rich and Poor, Inequality in America. And about a half hour of it, maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes of it, something like that, is me. So sitting down with one of the editors over at Link TV and talking about Rich and Poor in America and my new book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, all that kind of stuff. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ.
Hi, I used to work in education, and as a teacher or school personnel, if you even suspect that a child is being abused sexually or otherwise, you are legally obligated to report that. Now,
yeah, and
why
that's
isn't Dennis Hastert held to this same standard?
Well, and I believe that the law is that he is. I don't think that there's any exceptions. It used to be that there was an exception for priests and doctors, and they've removed those exceptions as well. So if any, my understanding of the law, and perhaps this is a state-by-state variation, and maybe in Washington, D.C., which has its own weird set of laws, it's different, but I believe that, you know, if anybody has direct knowledge of a child being abused, they fail to report it, they have committed a criminal act in and of themselves. So,
I'll tell you something else. If parent had treated their children the way this government has treated its citizens for the last 5 years, there's not a court in the world that wouldn't take those kids away and put them in a foster home.
Well said, KJ. Thanks a lot for the call. Andrea in Snyder County, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrea.
Hello. I just wanted to let you know that I just heard about Don Sherwood as our congressman.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to know if there's something that can be done to get him defeated so that he will not be our congressman any longer.
He's your member of Congress?
Pardon me?
He's your member of Congress?
He's supposed to be our congressman, Don Sherwood.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know who's running against him?
No, I don't. I'm not really familiar with too much because I'm a shut-in.
Yeah, well, that's step one, would be to look in the phone book or call information and get the phone number for the county Democratic Party, whatever county you're in. And you're in Snyder County, Pennsylvania, so find the Democratic Party or call for that matter, there's probably a toll-free number for the Democratic National Committee, the DNC. Call 1-800-555-1212 and get that phone number. And find out who the Democratic candidate is who's running against Don Sherwood and get a phone number for them and then call their office and say, you know, is there any way that I can help? Do you need me to make a few phone calls on voting on election day to get the vote out? Or, you know, can I send you $10 or, you know, anything? You know, that, you know, at least know the person's name. Write a letter to the editor of the newspaper.
I was really astounded to hear this news that he was actually in Washington and he's out for re-election, and yet they've got this lawsuit against him, or this woman does in D.C.
Yeah,
I was appalled.
Yeah, his mistress suing him. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, and so, you know, just getting the word out, Andrea. That's step one.
Well, I intend to do that.
Good.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling, Bill in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. This is you're pretty much my main source of what happens in Congress on a day-to-day basis. I listen to you at work. I think it was last week you were telling me that. There was a report on who owns the media that was suppressed by Congress.
It was actually it wasn't a report on who owns the media. It was a report on the effect of the concentration of media in a small number of hands with regard to television. And what they found was that as the concentration of media into a small number of corporate hands went up, the number of minutes devoted to local news stories went down. And that was an FCC study that was buried. In fact, they ordered it shredded.
I thought it was a report on who owned the media, and I was.
No, the ownership of the media is fairly transparent. You know, they're the owner. I mean, these are public corporations by and large, and other than Fox, which is owned by Murdoch, which I don't think that you can buy shares in Fox. I may be wrong, but I don't think so. I think Murdoch is pretty much the sole guy. But all the rest of them are quite transparent. You know,
I was wondering if the misinformation delivered by Fox could be considered campaign donations.
Well, you know, in Washington State, they had this interesting case last year where there were a couple of local DJs who were pushing a ballot initiative, and a court ruled that was, for all practical purposes, a campaign donation. And if that stands, number one, it could have a spooky effect. I you know, frankly, you know, it's hard to say where it would go, but it could have a spooky effect on talk radio in general, conservative, liberal, right across the board. And on the other hand, number two, if it stood, it could be used to say, well, Fox News is really Republican propaganda. It's not really news, but who knows? 27 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Desperate for changing, starving for truth. Closer to where I started, chasing after you. I'm falling even more in love with you.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. Time to check in on what's going on with the American occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight and to die. And they're alive in the balance.
The following are security and other developments in Iraq reported on Wednesday as of 1500 GMT by Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, at least 14 people were killed and 75 wounded in a car bomb attack in central Baghdad, which Interior Ministry sources said targeted the convoy of Iraq's industry minister. In Mogadia, Iraqi police said they killed 11 foreign fighters, including 9 Syrians in that town north of Baghdad. In Ramadi, a suicide truck bomber blew himself up outside the Iraqi army headquarters in western Ramadi. In Kirkuk, an Iraqi army brigadier escaped an assassination attempt when his vehicle was struck by a roadside bomb. Near Kirkuk, a U.S. soldier died of wounds sustained on Tuesday when he was struck by enemy fire in that city. In Mosul, several mortar rounds landed at an army recruitment center, killing four recruits and wounding eight others in Mosul. In Baghdad, a car bomb killed a man and wounded four others in the Dura district. Also in Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol wounded a policeman and a civilian in central Baghdad's Wathiq Square. Insurgents shot a U.S. soldier dead on Tuesday in eastern Baghdad. In Baqaba, gunmen attacked a police patrol, killing two policemen and wounding four people in that town. In Mosul, the bodies of two people were found. A source in the hospital said they were shot in the head. Near Taz Kurmatu, police found three bodies. This is a town 43 miles south of Kirkuk. Near Tikrit, police found the body of a man who had been assassinated. In Sunia, gunmen killed a translator working for U.S. forces in that small town near the oil refinery town of Baiji. And in Ramadi, a suicide car bomber wounded four policemen when he rammed his car into the entrance of a police station in the insurgent stronghold town of Ramadi, 110 kilometers west of Baghdad. Now, in the midst of all this, this is something I find very interesting. I got an email from Ken Melman, the head of the RNC, a single guy. I'm not going to go there. I got an email from Ken Melman saying, who thinks I'm a Republican, right? Because, in fact, he's saying in Vermont, you need to be sure and get your absentee ballot. Here's where you can click to print it out or to get one. Because back when I lived in Vermont, you know, a couple of years ago, I gave $5 to the Republican Party to get on their mailing list because I wanted to get the inside scoop. And they've been sending me stuff ever since. So it says, you know, Dear Thomas, please, you know, please click here to get your absentee ballot so that you can vote by absentee ballot in Vermont. Now, why, I asked myself, are the Republicans trying to get Republicans to vote by absentee ballot? Is it that they don't trust the voting machines? Or could it be, actually, I don't think that that's the case. Here's an alternative scenario. Now, I'll give you an advance warning. This is out there, okay? I might be totally nuts here. And you know, I mean, you hear me put people on the air all the time and say, I think that they're nuts. This might be me being nuts. But just check this out. Let's say that you're the Republican Party, and you're going to rig the voting machines to steal an election. Now, prior to this election, there were exit polls. And in fact, the exit polls implied that the voting machines had been rigged. In the 2000 election, the 2002 election, and the 2004 election, in those districts where people voted on electronic voting machines, Republicans had a huge advantage compared to districts where people voted on paper. In fact, in some areas, like in New Mexico, for example, this led to the passage of a law in New Mexico. People would walk into a school, you know, a local precinct to vote, and some of them were given the machine, and some of them were given paper ballots because they had more people than they had machines. And so they just, you know, voted by absentee ballot right there on the spot. And oddly, the people who voted by paper voted to elect John Kerry, and the people who voted on the machine voted to elect George Bush. So if I was the Republican Party and I was going to steal an election by rigging the electronic voting machines, in the past I would have tried to somehow rig the polls, but there really was no way to rig the exit polls. But in the 2006 election, this election that's going to happen in about a month, there are no exit polls. I mean, they've all been shut down. Exit polls in the United States have become a fine art. They virtually never were wrong until the 2000 election. In the 2000 election, they went crazy. They showed that Al Gore won by a landslide. In the 2002 election, they showed that Max Cleland won in Georgia by 5, 6, 7 points. In the 2004 election, they showed that John Kerry won. But there's no exit polls in the 2006 election. But there is a paper trail, even in those places where electronic machines are being used. And that paper trail is called the absentee ballot. So what's going to happen is the absentee ballots are going to get opened and counted. And it's going to look really suspicious if the people who voted in the electronic voting machines, say, voted for the Democrats 55 to 45 over the Republicans, And the absentee ballots, excuse me, let me back up. It's going to look really suspicious if the people who voted on the electronic voting machines overwhelmingly elected the Republicans, but the paper ballots show that the Democrats won. So if you're going to rig an election, the only backup to show that the election hasn't been stolen right now is the absentee vote. People are going to be looking at the absentee vote and saying, okay, here's the absentee, here's an actual paper trail in an area where there's nothing but electronic machines. This paper trail shows that the majority of the people who voted, voted a particular way. And it's going to be assumed to be sort of like an exit poll. So if the Republicans can get an overwhelming number or a substantial number of their people to vote by absentee ballot, they will have a paper trail that they can hold up and say, see, along among the absentee ballots, we won by 5 points. So the machines that say that we won by 5 points must be right. So, you know, maybe I'm nuts. Maybe I'm nuts. And maybe not. Time will tell, eh? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Mike in Eureka, California. Hey, Mike.
Hello. Nice to talk with you, Tom. It seems like the overall theme today has been privatization.
Yeah.
Starting off with the very beginning. I mean, there
from schools to voting machines. Yep.
I'm sorry?
From schools to voting machines.
Yes. And I'm sure what you have on your monitor right now has the basic question that I did call in about, and it's a little bit goofy, but not really. I think it deems some respect, and that is the primary question of how do the progressives, if we at least get control of the House, and I'm a pessimist, I must say, but if we do get control of the House at least, how do we get how do we create three Karl Roves that are progressive?
We don't need
that can change this whole darn
thing. How do we fix the problem?
How do we fix the problem?
Okay, let me give you a rant about this, Mike.
Good. I thought that would open up okay. A good rant.
Thanks. In fact, I'm going to drop you here so I could just get into it. And thanks for the call, though. I appreciate it. If you look at the history of the United States, we were largely an agrarian society from the founding of this country up until the 1870s. Okay, it was agriculture was the basis of America. In the 1870s, corporations came into their own. In 1886, the Supreme Court, theoretically, it didn't actually, but that's what the law is, gave corporations rights of persons. And the first rule by corporate, you know, rule period of time emerged. The first great emergence of corporate rule, of laissez-faire economics, started in the 1860s, late 1860s, and extended all the way up to late 1890s, 1900, let's say. Right up until 1900. And what happened in 1900 was by that time, you had the wobblies that had emerged. I mean, labor was getting out there. You know, 90% of Americans were living below the poverty line. The average income in America was $9,700 a year. People were poor. People were protesting. The Grange movement, the farmers were striking. Unions were organizing. I mean, it was just this whole huge movement had emerged as a consequence of that. And that whole huge movement, when President McKinley was assassinated in 1900, his vice president, who had been a pro-corporate Republican, a wealthy pro-corporate Republican, suddenly became a progressive, Teddy Roosevelt. Why? Because that's where the nation was at. The nation was fed up. They had 25 years, 30 years of corporate rule, and they said, enough of this. We're not going to put up with it anymore. And Teddy Roosevelt, being a wise politician, he figured out that if he didn't want to get impeached or assassinated or thrown out, I mean, you've just seen McKinley assassinated. I would never advocate assassination as a political technique, but, you know, Roosevelt, seeing what had just happened to McKinley, thought, okay, the American people are enraged. We're gonna go in a different direction. He saw the light. I'll finish the story. This is a fascinating story about the history of America right after this break. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 9 minutes before the hour. Just a quick reminder, Thursday after I speak at the World Can't Wait meeting in Portland, tomorrow night I'll be at Annie Bloom's Books in Portland at 7:30 p.m. for our listeners on KPOJ, AM 620. For our listeners in Seattle on Talk 1090 in Seattle, I'll be on Friday night at Town Hall. $5 tickets through Elliott Bay Books Company. You can pick them up, and you can contact Elliott Bay Books at 206-624-6600. So it should be a lot of fun. I want to finish this story real quickly. First, I'm going to Linda in Tacoma. You have the World Can't Wait information for Seattle. If you want to just toss that out real quick, eh?
Yeah. Okay. It's 12 noon, Denny. And 11th up on Capitol Hill across from the college. And we're going to march downtown to the Pioneer Square, the public market.
Great.
Seattle Market. And then there's going to be one in Olympia, too.
And that's at?
10 to 4 on the Capitol steps.
On the Capitol steps. Great.
Yeah.
Linda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, here's the punchline to the story, and then I'll just wrap this thing that I was telling you before. And that is that a corporate regime, a total laissez-faire, rule-by-the-rich corporate regime in the United States has never lasted more than 30 years. They rise. They throw the people into poverty. The people throw them out. They say, enough of this. Throw them out. And then new leaders emerge who say, as Roy in Rio Rancho, you know, once said, he said, you know, politicians don't lead. They see a parade going down the street, and they run out in front of it and lift up a flag and say, hey, this is my parade. And that's exactly what Teddy Roosevelt did. McKinley was in the 1890s. President McKinley, was already tanking. He was a very unpopular Republican president, and his advisor, Mark Hanna, suggested, one of the ways to maintain political power and run for re-election successfully was by having a war. And so they said, well, the USS Maine, remember the Maine, the USS Maine down in Havana Harbor, its boiler blew up. And they said, that was the Spanish that blew it up and started the Spanish-American War in Cuba and in the Philippines against Spain. And we were in a 40-year guerrilla war in the Philippines. That's how long it took. That was the tail end of corporate rule. And I think, frankly, we're at that same point right now. So McKinley's gone, and in comes Teddy Roosevelt, good conservative, wealthy Republican. And he looks around and he says, not only has the political landscape changed, I don't think that this was a Machiavellian move on Teddy Roosevelt's part. I think he finally got it. It was like a critical mass was in the memosphere, the morphic resonance, whatever you call it. He got it, that America couldn't continue with this kind of poverty and this kind of, and he became the trust buster, and he started tearing down these huge corporate giants that had emerged in the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s. And from 1900 through World War I, through the end of the Wilson administration, you had through, say 1920, let's say, from 1900 through 1920, we had basically, 1919, we had an administration that was putting America back together, that were, busting up the trusts and calling the robber barons, right up front. And then the Republicans came back into power after Wilson. And from 1920 and for another 10, 15 years, we had, another rise of corporate rule. And poverty increased again in the 20s, the roaring 20s, right? They were roaring for the rich. poverty increased. And what did it do? The stock market, on the other hand, the rich got richer and richer. Yesterday, the stock market hit a new high. What does that mean? It means that, you know, the wealthy got wealthier. Does it have any impact on the average working person in America? Well, to the extent that the stock market goes up when big corporations lay off workers, yeah, I suppose it does. In other words, it means more people are probably getting laid off, more jobs are getting shipped to China if the stock market is going up. So in any case, we saw that in 1929, and it fell over. It became a teetering, tottering, and it fell over in 1929. And that led to the progressive reforms of Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt, the FDR regime or administration, you know, came out and said, no, we're going to go back to a progressive, you know, doing what Teddy Roosevelt was doing. We're going to go back to those progressive roots. And Franklin Roosevelt did that. And reinvented America, saying, you know, that essentially that the only thing that we had to fear was fear itself. I mean, this was his.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And that was in 1933. He was talking about the Great Depression. He was talking about an economic disaster. So this was the second time. I mean, there was the Great Panic of 1896, and then the Great Depression of 1929, 1930. This is the second Republican Great Depression. And so the Democrats, you know, figured this out, and they said, you know, not again. And then we had the rise of the third corporatocracy, which started in the 1980s. And we're 26 years into it. And they have never lasted more than 30 years before. And I frankly don't think this one is going to either. And that's the good news in my mind. Is that the people of America are waking up, and we don't need a Karl Rove. We just need an energized populace, as we've had in the past in this country. And they will throw the bums out. There is no doubt in my mind. Coming up on tomorrow's program, David Limbaugh, Rush's brother. He's going to tell us how the Republicans are good, Democrats are bad. And Andrew Dallas is here. He's going to talk about the greenback bomb. Iran and Russia are looking. They have us in their sights. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
And listening to the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.